I have two spots to fill, and as far as preachers go in the conference, I'm struggling with that, so just maybe I'll preach it, I don't know. Just kidding. But do pray. Psalm 63. We know that the Psalms were composed, of course, under divine inspiration. And I believe that the means and process of that information was not, inspiration was not merely the psalmist sitting down with his pen in hand, the purpose of composing a psalm, but I believe the Lord led him into a variety of experiences, some mournful, some joyful, and the Holy Spirit then filled him with deep feelings and developed these, and then the psalmist took his pen and the Holy Spirit dictated the words. And being written that way, they become a manual of our own experience, and that's why we can always find ourselves in the Psalms. No matter what you're going through, you can always find yourself in the Psalms. Psalm 63, the inscription is a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. Biblically, there are two possibilities of that occurrence. You remember David and his loyal band when they were refugees wandering in the wilderness of Judah when David had fled from the wrath of Saul. That was one occasion he was wandering in the wilderness of Judah. The other would have been when he fled from his son Absalom, from the military coup of Absalom. Really don't know which of these occasions, but either way, the psalm was written during a time of wilderness exile, written during a time of great trial. Would have been a time of humiliation for David, time of destitution, a time when things certainly looked bleak, a time of loneliness, and even though he had some people with him, time of anxiety and distress, no doubt a time of difficulty and trial, and a time of great need for the psalmist. So this psalm is written during a wilderness time. The wilderness, of course, is a very apt picture of the world, but this here is speaking of a certain time in the life of a child of God. The world is a wilderness, and we deal with that every day. But there are wilderness times for God's people as well, and that's the background or the setting of this psalm. We'll read the first 8 verses. O God, thou art my God. Early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee. He's talking to God. My flesh longeth for thee in a dry and thirsty land where no water is. To see thy power and thy glory, so as I have seen in the sanctuary, have I seen thee in the sanctuary. Because thy loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise thee. Thus will I bless thee while I live. I will lift up mine hands in thy name. My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise thee with joyful lips. When I remember thee upon my bed, and meditate on thee in the night watches, because thou hast been my help. Therefore in the shadow of thy wings will I rejoice. My soul followeth hard after thee. Thy right hand upholdeth me. The subject of the psalm is said in the very first verse. The subject, of course, is God. And it is of extreme importance that God be the subject, the theme, the issue of our life. That's true every day. But that is especially true in a wilderness time. So God is the subject. We see that the psalmist is very focused. He's talking to God. He's very focused upon God. In verse 1, we see the name God two times. There are 18 pronouns in the psalm referring to God. So that's 20 references to God in 8 verses. I believe it's safe to say that he's the subject. He is the focus of the psalm. In the very first verse, there are 5 references to God, the 2 names and then pronouns. So in one verse, there are 5 references to God. I want to speak this evening on God focus in the wilderness time. If that is not your focus in the wilderness time, you will be devoured in the wilderness time. God must be the priority. That's true every day of our life. But it's true in this wilderness time. The tone of the psalm is set in the very first word, oh. Again, as we've said before, it's a note of exclamation. It's a word of strong emotion. Oh, he could express anger, joy. Here, of course, it expresses joy. In verse 5, there are the words praise and joyful. And in verse 7, we see the word rejoice. So you get the idea of the tone of the song. It's one of joyfulness. Pretty hard to be focused upon God and that not be the case. It's a tone of excitement and thankfulness. In verse 8, the psalmist declares the overall engagement of his soul during this wilderness time. He would follow after God. Our soul is always engaged. We must make sure it's engaged in the right matters. And the engagement of the soul is determined by the focus of the soul. If our focus is God, our soul will be engaged Godwards. And we see that all through this psalm. First of all, his soul is engaged in a pursuit of God. And we've preached on this many times, how we are to pursue God. We're glad he pursues us, but we are to pursue God. We are to follow after God. We are to move in the direction of God. And what he says here in verse 1, early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh longeth for thee. Mirrors some other statements that are made by the psalmist, not necessarily David. But in Psalm 42, if you keep a mark in our text, in Psalm 42, verses 1 and 2, he says, as the hart panteth, that is the deer, panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. His soul's engaged. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? Psalm 143 in verse 6 we read, I stretch forth my hands unto thee. A picture of a longing. My soul thirsteth for thee in a has a thirsty land. Now in each of these, Psalm 63 verse 1, Psalm 42 1 and 2, and Psalm 143 6, we see what is involved is the innermost part of his being, my soul. He mentions that in every one of those verses, my soul. And in so doing, he paints a picture of one who is not content with a mechanical spirituality. It's his soul that is involved in this pursuit. He's not content with a mere pretense. He's not content with a mere appearance or formality. He's not satisfied with spiritual platitudes. There's a heartfelt expression, my soul, my soul. There's a heartfelt expression of someone who wants more of God in his life. We must always want more of God in our lives. Is there any one of us that has enough of God in our lives? The answer, of course, is no. The question is, the question is not whether or not we have enough of God in our lives. We know that's not the case. But the question is, are we satisfied with how much of God is in our life, or do we want more of God in our lives? And what we see here in Psalm 63 is an individual wanting more of God in his life. My soul followeth hard after thee, verse 8. He's moving in the direction of God. And we've preached on this several times. We must always move in the direction of God. At any time when we are not, we are on dangerous ground. We must be moving in the direction of God. That's why we need to always be checking, need to always be examining. What direction am I moving in? And I'm here to tell you, if you move in the direction of God, you might be the only one in your group. That is, you may be moving by yourself. But if that be the case, you're the only one going in the right direction. Move in the direction of God. You cannot go wrong moving in the direction of God. So he says, my soul followeth, present tense, continuous. It's not my soul followed at one time. My soul followeth, or my soul is following hard after thee. That's the same thing he's saying in verse 1 when he said, I seek thee. He's talking about a pursuit. The pursuit of his life is God. He's striving for the Lord. If you are pursuing God, that is a difficult pursuit because there's obstacles everywhere. I am pursuing God. I am striving. I am in quest for the Lord. I want more of God in my life. And again, this is the activity, the aim, and the goal of the soul. His innermost being. So in a wilderness time, or any time as far as that goes, move in the direction of God. Strive for God. Anybody can go with the stream. Any dead fish can go with the stream. But strive to move in the direction of God. And again, this is of the soul. In a wilderness time, continually, or any time, make God the activity of our soul. Make God the activity of our soul. Make God the aim and the goal of our soul. Make God the goal, the activity of our life. Now notice the object of the pursuit in verse 1. See, I seek thee. There are a lot of things we can seek. But this must be the subject. This must be the issue. I seek thee. God is the subject. God is the object. God is the focus. God is the goal. God is the issue. God is always the issue. We make all kinds of things the issue. God is always the main issue. There's never a time when that's not so. So we have to stay focused upon God. Now notice the manner of the pursuit is, I follow, in verse 8, my soul followeth hard after thee. Hard. That's the manner of the pursuit. It's laborious. I followeth hard after thee. It's energetic. It's zealous. It's passionate. It's earnest. It's persistent. I follow hard after thee. It speaks of the intensity of the pursuit. So you have the object of the pursuit is thee. You have the manner of the pursuit. It is hard. It is in the wilderness time. So it is a pursuit in despite of or in the midst of hardships. It is a pursuit in the teeth of contrary winds. So it's not merely a wishing for something. This isn't a passing emotion. His soul is engaged in an earnest pursuit of God. My soul followeth hard after thee. There is a single-mindedness. There is a single-mindedness for God. There is intense effort. There is perseverance. And all of this requires God's assistance or God's help or God's strength. And we see that at the end of verse 8. Thy right hand upholdeth me. That will always be the case. If we are following hard after God, if we are determined to move in the direction of God, God's right hand upholds us. In other words, God gives us the strength to do so. So you see, there, this is where we find strength. We do not find strength moving away from God. We find strength moving in the direction of God. It is then that God's right hand upholds us. We don't read that God's hand upholds us when we go the opposite direction. It's when we're following hard after Him that we feel His upholding strength, which, of course, enables us to continue. To continue to follow. We must draw strength from Him. We must know that it is outside of our power to kindle and continue this pursuit of God. It requires the strength of the Lord. That's always so. So we see the focus, we see the subject of the psalm is God. It's all summed up there in verse 8. But there are some things that lead to verse 8. Verse 1 and verse 8 ought to describe our lives. But there are things that are absolutely necessary if that is to be so. In other words, you can't just determine tonight, from now on I'm going to seek after God. It doesn't work that way. You can't just roll out of bed tomorrow and determine, I'm going to seek God from here on out. There's more to it than that. There are some matters. If we're to do this continually, there are some matters that must be deeply ingrained in our hearts. deeply ingrained in us. Again, not just passing emotions. So many try to serve God on present emotions. It doesn't work. There's no perseverance. There's no continual engagement of the soul for God. This requires something more than just passing emotions. And these matters must define our being. They must be us. And if they are us, we find ourselves declaring the same thing that the psalmist declared in verse 1, and we find ourselves living in verse 8. My soul followeth hard after thee. And as I do that, he upholds, he gives strength to continue on. First of all, what needs to be ingrained in our hearts is a personal recognition and an attachment to the Lord. It must be ingrained in us. The psalm opens with a heartfelt declaration. O God, thou art my God. O God, thou art my God. In those words, there is a knowledge of God. O God, thou art my God. If we are going to continuously follow hard after God, we have to know Him. We have to know Him. There's also in those words an acceptance and a realization and a consciousness and a gratitude of who and what God is. Now you'll notice, though the word God appears two times, one is all capital letters, and the other is capital G, small case, O-D. O God, all capital letters, that's Jehovah. It's true when you see all capital letters, Lord. It's true when you see all capital letters, God. That's Jehovah. Now in the Bible, you might see Jehovah God, Lord God. You might see the other. Whatever comes first is the emphasis. And here it is, Jehovah. Emphasizing, of course, is immutability. We must recognize His immutability. It also emphasizes the self-existence of God. That is, God doesn't need anything outside of Himself to exist. It's the self-existence of God. And then there's the word God. Elohim. Elohim. What's emphasized in the name Elohim is strength, power. It is the strength and power of Jehovah. So he says, O God, O Jehovah, thou art my Elohim. That is, thou art my strength and my power. O God, thou art my God. So there's an acknowledgement of who and what God is. He's immutable, He's self-existent. He's powerful. We see the psalm again begins, O God, thou art. Continually. Ongoing. That is, He's always Jehovah. He's always Elohim. And He is my God. That makes it personal. That means the psalmist is not merely recognizing the existence of God. He is recognizing and he is seeing the relevance of God in his life. Now there are many people who acknowledge the existence of God, but see no relevance of God in their life. Sadly, I believe that's true of many of God's people. They acknowledge God, they acknowledge Christ, but there's no connection between God and their life. But he says, my God. So he recognizes God is Jehovah, God is Elohim, but he's my God. In other words, there is a relevance. Who God is relevant to my life. What God is relevant to my life. This will enable you to continue seeing that God is relevant in your life. And again, I've said this many times, I believe one of the reasons, there may be many, but one of the reasons, there's no doubt in my mind that so many of God's people are always discouraged is because they have some head knowledge, but they see no relevancy of it in their life. They can't connect the two. Well, that will discourage you. That will frustrate you. That will cause great frustration. You know all of these truths, but I can't get them to relate to my life. That's horrible. But that's where many people live. So it is this recognition of God that is a part of the foundation. This is the foundation of living in verse 8 of Psalm 63. Also in verse 1, we see another thing that must be ingrained in us, and it follows the recognition of who God is and what God is. There's a personal desire for God. There is a personal desire for God. What that means is that David had an attraction to God. Oh God. He's attracted to that. There's a drawing. Thou art my God. He has a preference for God. If you desire something, it means you have a preference. He has a preference for God. That is, you put the world on one side, God on the other. He has a preference for God. You put my ways on one side, God's ways on the other. He has a preference for God. That's what we mean by a desire for God. This desire inclines him toward God. He has an inclination toward God. If we are not, as God's people, inclined toward God, there's something seriously wrong with us. There ought to be an inclination, a leaning toward God. There ought to be something that moves us in the direction of God. And what it is that knowledge, oh God, thou art my God. So he has a desire for God. He has a fervor for God. He has a yearning. He has a craving. He has an appetite for God. And this feeds upon, again, the first part of the verse, O God, thou art my God. Once that is settled, once that is ingrained in us, then we have an appetite. We have a desire for God. And he goes on in verse 1 and he describes this desire. He says, early will I seek thee. Early will I seek thee. Because thou art God and because thou art my God. And because I desire God. Early will I seek thee. Now the word early, of course, is indicative of earnestness and priority. He's earnest for God. God is a priority. Early will I seek thee. He expends energy toward God. And again, it's an energy that takes priority. He goes on in his description by saying, my soul thirsteth for thee, my flesh longeth for thee. So in that little statement, you have two verbs, thirsteth and longeth. And those two verbs, of course, describe his desire for God. You also have two nouns, soul and flesh. And that expresses the extent of his desire. And what it shows is that his desire was something that consumed his entire being. Soul and flesh, inward and outward. It was a desire that consumed him. And again, once we realize, once it's ingrained in us, who God is, that He is relevant to our lives, there is now a desire that consumes us. Not just a part of us, not just something that we fit into our lives when it's convenient to do so. But this is a desire that consumes us. Is there not something wrong if we do not have a consuming desire for God? Something is seriously wrong, if that's the case. He then proceeds to describe the urgency of his desire. In a dry and thirsty land where no water is. That makes the desire urgent. He's in a place where he cannot get water. He needs God. It is an urgent desire. We need to have a desire for God. We need to feel a sense of urgency toward God. I need God. I need Him right now. At this very moment, there's an urgency of desire. And then again, the object of the desire is further explained in verse 2. To see, this is what he longs for. To see thy power and thy glory. He says, I have an urgent desire for God. To see His power. To experience His power. To experience His glory or His beauty and magnificence. His power would refer to His influence and His dominance. He says, I desire to experience His dominance. I desire to see or to experience His beauty and His magnificence. Therefore, early will I seek Thee. And notice this desire is based upon a past experience. To see Thy power and Thy glory, so has I have seen Thee in the sanctuary. In other words, he has in the past seen the power of God. He in the past has seen the glory of God. It's happened before. And that past experience of God feeds a desire for another experience of the Lord. We need past experiences. The problem is you can't live on past experience. Your past experience must feed a desire for the present. I saw God back here. I experienced His power. I experienced His beauty. And now I'm here and I want to experience it again. So you see, the past fed his desire. And spiritual experience feeds desire. It feeds desire. So one will never live consistently in verse 8 without this deep-seated knowledge of who God is, what God is, and without this deep-seated desire for the Lord. Also notice that there's a personal awareness of the emptiness of the world. In verse 1, in a dry and thirsty land where no water is. So he's very aware of his surroundings. He's not ignorant of his circumstances. He's not ignorant of his surroundings. He knows he's in a dry and thirsty land where no water is. That is, there's nothing in this place that can satisfy my soul. And that's why he desires and longs for God. So there must be the realization. There must be the awareness that the world is spiritually parched. It is not the place that is going to feed our soul. Now, a lot of God's people don't know that, because they seek satisfaction in the world that only God can give. Now, we understand the lost man doing that. He doesn't know any better. But a child of God, that's a real problem. A child of God must realize that this world is spiritually withered and barren. I'm not going to find what I need in this world. And that must be deeply ingrained in us. That we are not, this world cannot produce. It cannot produce what I need spiritually. What I need spiritually, I can only find in one place or in one person. And that's God. And that feeds this desire for the Lord. And it eclipses. Once you realize that this world has nothing for my soul. Yes, you can have a good time in the world and all of that stuff. But the world will not feed your soul. It will not happen. And that is why even if you're doing a worldly thing, and I'm not using worldly there in a bad way, you need to be moving in the direction of God. Even if you're doing something you enjoy in the world, not necessarily something bad, but God gives us the world to use the world and to enjoy it, but even then, you have to be moving in the direction of God, realizing that even this enjoyment, this thing that I enjoy, is not going to feed my soul. Only God can do that. And the soul must always be engaged. And if it's not, we get ourselves in a lot of trouble. We see also a personal conviction concerning the excellency of God. So he realizes in verse 1 his circumstances. He's in a dry and thirsty land where no water is. In verse 3, because thy loving kindness is better than life. Thy loving kindness is better than. You can put whatever you want after than. And it's true. God is better than. Here it is, God is better than life. Now, notice this is the reason for his desire. He says, because thy loving kindness is better than life. He gives the reason stated for what he stated prior to. The reason he desires God, the reason he seeks God, the reason, because God is better. We seek what we think is best. You don't seek what you know is bad. You seek what you think is best. And therefore we must be convinced. It must be ingrained in us, God is better. God is better. Therefore, I seek God. So, because thy loving kindness is better. God is more suitable to my soul than anything in the world. God is more fitting. God is more useful. God is more valuable, more beneficial than anything else. This conviction must take hold upon us. And again, we'll not live in verse 8 until that happens. Not on a continual basis. Also, there's a personal determination for God. In verse 3, again, there's a logical order here. There's a personal knowledge of God, who He is, what He is. There's a personal desire for God. There's a personal awareness and conviction that God is better, or that the world is spiritually empty place, and that God is better. And then he says, my lips shall praise thee. He has a determination. He has a resolve. Because of all these other things, he's now resolved for God. I will do such and such. There's also a personal faith in the sufficiency of God. Verse 5. My soul shall be satisfied with marrow and fatness. One of the first lessons we need to learn is what satisfies and what doesn't. The world does not satisfy the soul. God does. We must realize if we want satisfaction, we must seek God. So he says, my soul shall be satisfied. My soul shall be satisfied. The inner part of me shall be satisfied with marrow and fatness. And then we see there's a personal delight in God in verse 6. When I remember thee upon my bed and meditate on thee in the night watches. Those are the words of someone who is enamored with God. He says, when I'm in bed, I'm going to remember thee. When I remember thee upon my bed and meditate on thee in the night watches. There's soul satisfaction in meditating, thinking about God. Can you pursue something without thinking about it? I don't think so. We are to pursue God. So we have to be thinking about God. If you give very little thought to God through the day, don't deceive yourself into thinking that you are pursuing God. You have to think upon Him. He's on your mind if you're pursuing Him. And let's be honest, there are a lot of other things that get on our minds. Because, and then verse 7, because thou hast been my help. In the past, there's past experience again. Past experience feeds the present. Therefore, in the shadow of thy wings will I rejoice. Because you've helped me in the past, I'll rejoice in the present. I'll rejoice in the present. Well, what if he doesn't help in the present? You rejoice that he's helped in the past. That's what he's saying here. Because. Again, a reason. Because thou hast been my help, I'll trust in thee. Every time God comes to our aid, it's just a reminder for us in the future. Trust Him. Trust Him. Trust Him. Past experience is a good teacher. And then verse 8, my soul followeth hard after thee. Oh, that would always be so of all of us, that our soul follows hard after God. Hard shows, again, it shows an eagerness, but it also shows that it takes energy to pursue God. It takes perseverance. There's difficulties, there's obstacles in the way. But I will follow, my soul followeth hard after thee. So we need to ask ourselves, in what are souls engaged in? What is the engagement of our soul? What is our focus? What is the subject? What is the issue? It should be God. That's always the issue. God. Circumstances don't change the issue. Circumstances don't change the subject. Circumstances shouldn't change our pursuit. Needs to be God. Needs to be God. That needs to be so every day. It's something we ought to pray for every day. God would cause us to pursue, to focus upon Him. Do we always succeed? Of course not. But you just keep praying that God cause you to be focused upon Him and to keep moving in the direction of the Lord. You know, and as you move in the direction of God, you may be the only one in your family, you may be the only one in your circle that's doing so. And you may begin to think, maybe I'm crazy. No, they are. As long as you're moving in the direction of God, you're going in the right direction. And we need to always remember that. Don't let anyone talk you out of moving in the direction of the Lord. Because you can't go wrong moving in the direction of God. Goes against human reason, goes against a lot of things, but it's always the right way. Move in His direction. Brother Jim, if you'd come and lead us.